welcome to the Fertility Conversations podcast. The goal of this podcast is to create more awareness about infertility and to provide support to people trying to conceive. Thank you for listening today, and we hope you will be encouraged. And now, here is your host, Ola.
Welcome to episode 10. Today, I'm joined by a lovely guest, Kemi Oloe. She's an infertility advocate and is very passionate about bringing awareness to infertility within the Black community. Kemi lives in the UK and has given talks about infertility in London and also in Dubai. Kemi will be speaking with us today about our experience with PCOS, infertility, and IVF. You can follow her on Instagram at Kemi_Kems. She's the founder of 9 Months in Waiting, a blog dedicated to encouraging those currently on their fertility journey. Her details would also be in the episode summary. So welcome, Kemi, and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Yay. To start off, please tell me a little bit about yourself.
Okay, so I love the introduction that you gave. As you were talking, I was like, oh, well, that's me. Okay, so I'm Kemi. I am 35. I've been married for, it's going to be 9 years this July. Oh, yeah, it's this month. And I have a three-year-old son, called Samuel. I love talking about all things infertility, raising awareness about it, breaking the stigma and the taboo, especially within the Black community. And I, based on my recent health issues, I also love talking about breast cancer awareness and teaching people how to check their breasts and know what to look out for. During my day job, I am a mortgage and insurance broker, and I've been doing that since 2012. And my husband and I also run a few Subway franchises as well.
Wow.
And I love church. I absolutely love church.
Wonderful, really busy lady, aren't you?
Yeah.
So much going on. So today, I know you mentioned as well that you recently also talk about breast cancer awareness. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Because I'm sure, you know, most people that have been listening anyway will be some female, and they can also learn from any advice that you can give us in terms of people checking for early detection and...
Yeah. Okay. My breast cancer journey started just shortly after breastfeeding with Samuel, that I found a lump. But because I'd never breastfed before, I just assumed that the lump was something to do with me stopping breastfeeding him after a year. So I kind of ignored it. And it was only because it was really painful that I went to the GP to get it checked out. They then referred me to the hospital and they told me it was my breast milk drying up. So I thought, okay, well, that's what I thought. And then I went away. The lump started getting slightly bigger. I went back and the lady said again, you know, this is breast milk. I've told you already, it's hormonal. It's just your body going back to normal. And it was the student in the room who picked something out on the screen and questioned something. And that's when she got the second opinion. And then in 2018, that's why I got the diagnosis. So it was a long 18 month treatment plan where chemotherapy, surgery, radiotherapy, it was a hard journey, but through it all I just thought, well, it is what it is. If the breast is stopping me from living, then take it away, and let's just get on with it, really, because I'd been through infertility and I know what it feels like for your body to be under so much in terms of multiple rounds of IVF. I just thought, well, if I can spend 5 years waiting on a child and putting my body through so, so much, then there's no way that I'm just going to give in to something called cancer. So now I just really want people to know how to check their breasts, because I didn't know how to check my breasts. It was only because the lump hurt. Other than that, I didn't know what the proper procedures were. So it's really important that you check your breast. So what they do say is check it on the first of every month. So, you know, you're checking it at the same time every month. look in the mirror, you know, pay attention to your breasts, like feel around, make sure if anything feels different from your normal breast tissue, go and get it checked out. It doesn't matter how many times you go, just go, because you know your body. And I think I'm an example of, you know, if I didn't go back, the likelihood as the type of cancer that it was, like, I probably would be here by now telling my story. So I'm just a very big advocate for that. And also because Black women are most likely to die from breast cancer than anyone else. And there's not enough medical research to tell us why. I don't want to get into the Black Lives Matter thing, there's just not enough research. They give you the stats to say, okay, as a Black woman, you're most likely, I can't remember if it's 4 times more likely to die than your white counterpart. But no one can give us any evidence as to why this is, what our body and how our body reacts to cancer. So right. I'm just on a mission just to get everyone to check, and check again.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for telling us about that, because again, like I noted earlier, people, we all have to, breast cancer is something that impacts a whole lot of people, so yeah. Being able to have early detection is great, and it's good, like you said, to that you kept on going back, and even that the student noticed something different and questioned it, because who knows what could have happened if you hadn't been persistent.
Yeah, definitely.
Thank you. And so just going back now into the infertility journey, I know you talked about that a little bit while just talking that. Can you tell us about your infertility journey? You said it took about 5 years, but just,
I kind of think that my fertility journey started at age 19 when I was actually diagnosed with polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS. Prior to that, it had just been multiple visits to hospitals and GPs because of really bad stomach aches, bloating, like excessive weight gain, missed periods, periods lasting 2 weeks, periods lasting 3 weeks. I've just been constantly told that because I'm young, it would regulate itself. Or when I was in secondary school, it was because you play a lot of sports, that's why your period is not regular. But at 19, after passing out at uni, being taken to hospital, that's when they really did the investigations and said, hey, this looks like it's polycystic ovary syndrome. And when the consultant told me what it was, he said, don't worry, it's just a hormone imbalance. A lot of people get it. It just means that you're most likely to put on weight quite easily. He just gave me a whole list of things. And then at the end, he said, and you may have problems conceiving in the future. So at 19, I'm not thinking about having a baby anytime soon. Mm-hmm. So I thought, okay, that's not a passing comment to make, you know, elaborate on it. And he said, don't worry, you know, if need be, we'll cross that bridge when we come to it. So I kind of put it in the back of my mind, and They for a number of years, they'd been asking me about whether I wanted to go on the pill to regulate my period. I didn't want to do it because, A, I'm a Nigerian kid, you know, you don't go on the pill, you don't. And I thought, I can't say to my mum, I'm going to go on the pill because she's going to think I have sex. So I didn't know what to do. So I thought, well, if this pill was going to help regulate my period, and then at the time, I think I was really self-conscious about my skin, and I was getting spots, and I'd read somewhere that, you know, the pill can help with spots, so I thought, well, let's just do it.
Yeah.
So I did it, and my mum was like, don't tell anybody they had taken the pill. She was like, don't say that, don't go and say it outside. And I was on the pill for quite a while, and I was just under the impression that they gave me Cerazette at first, the one that you take for 21 days with no break or something. So I took that one, and I was under the impression that I was actually getting a period because that's what the pill does. It was only later on that I realised that the pill, yes, you bleed, but it is just a bleed. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're ovulating. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's a real period. And that was just because I just happened to bump into a friend of mine from church who is a pharmacist, and she gave me the pill.
Right.
She said, why are you taking this? And I told her, and she said, Kemi, this thing isn't real. you know, it gives you, it just gives you an artificial bleed that you don't know what you're putting into your system, and you don't know what, whether your body's actually doing what it's supposed to do. So when she said that, I thought, okay, let me go and speak to the GP about it. And then they changed my pill to, I think it's, I can't remember what the other pill was called, but it's the one that you took for, that we take the 7-day break.
Right.
And then I got married at 26, and my husband and I, we said, you know what, like, we want to travel. We don't want to have children straight away. Although everyone just thought, as soon as you get married, bam, 9 months.
Yeah, 9 months time.
No, we said, no, we've got a lot, there's a lot of things that we want to do. So I carried on taking the pill maybe for about 6 months or so. And then I remember one day we just sat down based on like conversations that we'd had with some of our friends. And we sat down and we said, let's not do this pill thing. Because again, we'd researched and we realized that the pill can take a number of months to come out of your system.
Right.
So we said, let's take it away. God knows that we don't want a child until 2 years. So let's just see. And if it happens, it happens. And then it didn't happen. It didn't happen. So in the back of my mind, I started getting a bit worried that, hang on a minute, even though I know what we said, that we want to wait 2 years, but the fact that we're not using any sort of contraception and this isn't happening, I started getting a bit worried. And then a year passed, nothing. And that's when I think the depression really kicked in, because I wasn't having a period every month. So every month I was spending money on pregnancy tests thinking that I was pregnant. And it got to the point where I thought, okay, well, is it that the pill's taking too long to come out of my system? Or is my body just not working? What's going on? And in the UK, when you want to be referred for fertility investigations, they say that you have to be trying for more than a year. Sometimes they say more than 2 years.
Oh, wow.
So I just went to my GP and I said, I've been my husband, we got married in 2011. And I said, we've been together since 2009. And I just let them assume whatever it was that they wanted to assume. Yeah. And they said, oh, wow, that's a long time. Yes. So they said, okay, let's have a look into it. So the first thing that they did was they sent me for a scan and they said, yes, we can see that you've got polycystic ovaries, no problem. And then they said, we need to check to see whether you're ovulating or whether there's anything on your ovaries that we may have to have surgery for. And then I went for a laparoscopy, and following the results for that, they said, look, everything looks normal. Yes, you have cysts on your ovaries. They're very, very tiny. They're not cause for concern or anything. So just carry on. I said, okay. And then following that, I then had a colonoscopy as well to check. They said, there's nothing wrong with you. And they said, look, to be honest with you, we just think that you're one of the people that it's probably just taken a long time. So you kind of leave the hospital, those appointments feeling, okay, there's hope. But every month that you take another pregnancy test, it was almost soul destroying, because you just think, what am I not doing right? You know, I started changing the way that I ate. I started exercising more. I started reading more, researching more about PCOS. There's no cure for PCOS, but if you manage your lifestyle the correct way, then it is definitely manageable. I started researching on people who had gotten pregnant with PCOS, and then I found out about a drug called metformin. So I went back to my GP and I said, I need to be on metformin. And he said, no, that's normally for people with diabetes. I said, no, I've done my research. I need it. And then I think I went back maybe 4 times or so. He finally gave it to me. And I was so sick. I was so, so ill. It was when I read the side effects on the back of that, the box, I think I had every single one of them. It was so horrible. Yeah, it was. And then I passed out. This is when I was working in the bank. And I just remember just passing out in the bank. And then I was taken to hospital. And they said, they was like, what are you taking? I said, metformin. They said, look, I don't think this is going. I don't think this, you know, is compatible with you. Go back to your GP. Yeah. So I went back to my GP and I said, this metformin's not working. And he said to me, metformin would never give anyone those type of side effects. And this is the GP that had already said to me, you know, why are you in a hurry to get pregnant? You know, you guys are still young. And then, so that, I think that came, that was about end of 2012. And then in January 2013, I started spotting, but because my periods were irregular, or sometimes I had really light periods, I just thought, oh, it was just a period. So one day it was there, the next day it wasn't, then it came back. And I remember my friend saying to me, take a pregnancy test. And I was like, there's no way that I'm pregnant. Like, I didn't have a period last month, so, you know, you have to ovulate and blah. And I was explaining to her the calculations as to why I couldn't be pregnant. And then we got home, my husband said, just take the test. And I took it. I found out that I was actually pregnant.
Wow.
And I was so, so happy, because I didn't understand how I hadn't had a period since maybe, so this was January, I think November or so, and I managed to get pregnant. I just thought, well, you know, God is God.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. So the following couple of weeks, I told my mom and she was really happy. And then I was getting really bad stomach cramps, and the bleeding just started getting heavier and heavier. And I was saying to my husband, oh, it doesn't feel right. And he said, oh, no, you know, most people still bleed when they're pregnant. And I think deep down I knew that something wasn't right, because it was just so painful. And it was at the same time in the evening, maybe around 7 o'clock, that I'd literally just be crying in pain.
Wow.
And then maybe after a week or so, the pain was just too much. And I said, you know, I can't do this. And the blood was just like, it was just gushing out. And then we went to the hospital, and I remember needing to go toilet. And I remember just sitting on the toilet, and it was just, but literally, like, it was almost like I was urinating, but it was just blood. And then they said, okay, we're gonna give you an ultrasound. But then it turned out that the ultrasound department was closed. So then they said, okay, we're gonna have a feel around. And they said, okay, it still seems okay, but we're going to keep you in overnight, and then we'll have an ultrasound tomorrow to see. And I was like, okay. And I just kept praying and praying, like, God, please, please, just, you know, let it just be one of those people. Let me be one of those people that bleed during pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So the next day, we had the ultrasound, and the lady said, oh, I'm sorry, your fetus is on its way out. And that was, I can't even explain to you how I just wanted the ground to just follow, like, open up and swallow me, because I felt that, you know, I'd been waiting for something. Yes, it had been 2 years I'd been waiting, but it was just like, I just thought, God, why would you give me something and take it away in 2 weeks? I didn't even have time to enjoy it. You know, I just genuinely didn't understand. And then when I got home, I went to the toilet, and then it just dropped out, literally, into the toilet. So that was very, it was just such a traumatic experience for me. But I'll never forget the words of this nurse who said, well, looking at your records, I know that you had, you thought you had issues before, but at least now you know that you can get pregnant. And I thought it was so insensitive. You don't say that to someone who has been waiting that long for a baby, yeah, and then loses a baby and says, well, at least you know you can get pregnant. Who says that? So that just turned, but there were people around me who, like, we told, and they was like, well, we thank God, at least we know that there's no issues. And then I kind of felt that maybe that's what I should think, that, well, at least I know I can get pregnant. So I just carried on. I didn't grieve or anything. I just moved on. And then my husband, he had already booked us a trip to New York. So we went to New York, and I just blocked everything out. I think it was only months later that I realized that this thing has actually affected me. I don't feel like I've gotten over it. At the end of the day, yes, it was 2 weeks, but, you know, that was a baby, you know. I don't care how the world classifies it as fetus, embryo, I don't care. That was my baby that I'd lost. And I didn't feel like I was given the space to grieve and to proper be upset and cry about it. So that, I think that then just sent me into a place of just a really dark place of just, don't talk to me. I don't want to talk to anyone. I don't want to go out. I just want to be alone. I don't want to pray. I don't want to do anything. And that was just a constant cycle. So some months I'd be okay, and there's some months that I wouldn't be. And then, so that's 2013. We get to 2014, still no baby, nothing's happening. Going back and forth to the GP, and they're saying, look, there's nothing wrong with you. We've tested your husband, we've tested you, there's nothing wrong. This is unexplained infertility. That doesn't mean anything.
No.
When people say, what does unexplained infertility mean? It doesn't give you any explanations, nothing. There's no cure for it. There's no reason as to why it's happened. It's just you getting pregnant is taking longer than the average person, but keep trying because we know that you can get pregnant. So we got to 2014, the end of 2014, and just being in such dark places. I mean, to the point where I had suicidal thoughts. I just kept saying, God, if I die now, it doesn't matter, because my husband can go and marry someone else and she can give him a baby, you know. And that's all I kept saying. And I remember him saying to me, babes, I didn't marry you for babies. I married you for who you are. And if we have children, it's just an added bonus. And he kept saying that to me. He always repeat it, you know. And it took a lot, because I felt that my body was failing me, that I'm a woman. You know, when people look at me as a woman, they see someone who's supposed to be a mother. And I felt that I wasn't living up to my own expectations or the world's expectations of what the definition of a woman was. That really took a toll on me. And then I started doing a little bit more research into the Bible as to, like, women who were labeled as barren and, you know, what happened to them. And then my husband and I decided that we'd go to seek private healthcare and speak to a private clinic. And so we paid out the consultation and everything. And I remember the consultant said to us, you live in this borough in Essex where you're actually eligible for them to fund your treatment. And we said, well, look, we've been going back and forth to the GP for how long? He doesn't want to refer us. And she said that she'd write a letter to the GP to recommend that they refer us for treatment. And the GP was fuming. He could not believe that someone would do that. He said, how dare she write a letter to me? He was so angry. And he still didn't write the letter. So I then had to book another appointment and said, I don't want to see my allocated GP. I want to see someone else. And it happened to be a locum GP. And the receptionist, who said, look, I'm going to help you, you know. And they ended up writing the referral letter for us. And that's how it started. Jeez. We had our first, So I really felt like the devil was really against it.
Yeah.
Didn't want this to happen. So 2015, we had our first round of IVF. And when I thought about IVF, all I see is what I saw in the movies. I thought, you have IVF, you get pregnant straight away, and you have twins.
Twins or triplets, yeah.
That was it. I said, babes, imagine if we have four at the same time. You know, I was so excited. And but nothing prepared me for the trauma of IVF. Mm. You know, they sit you down and they say, okay, this is what can happen. And then because you've got PCOS, you're like 10 times more likely to have, you know, hyperstimulation, which is what I had. And that is, I can't even explain that pain, because you stimulate yourself. So I had to stimulate for, I think it was about 12 to 15 days, which is more than the average person, to get the follicles to the right size. I then did the egg collection, and my abdomen was just full of fluid. I was in so much pain that we had to call the ambulance. I was taken to hospital, and then I was in hospital for 5 days. And then when we did the transfer, so they collected 21 eggs, and then I think out of the 21, maybe 8 fertilized or something. And then, so from fertilization to transfer, that's 5 days. By the time it got to 5 days, only one had made it. I said, it's okay. Oh, wow. Because all it takes is
that's one. Yeah. You know, that's what people say.
All it takes is one. I'm just praying for a child. Yeah. You know? So that's it. So when we did the transfer, so there's a common saying in trying to conceive language, you poopo, pregnant until proven otherwise. Oh, I was so happy. I said, well, this is it. This is my baby. Within 3 days, I started bleeding. Gosh. And that was it. It was over. And I just thought, and it took a lot for me to process that, because all I saw online and on TV were success stories. And I thought, this is absolutely crazy. How comes mine didn't work? Why am I so different? I just don't get it. So then you have to wait 3 months. So we waited 3 months. We did another round. This time it was different because by the time they'd done the egg collection, they'd already cancelled the cycle. They said, look, during the egg collection, you were hiccuping. We could see that the abdomen was, the water was already in your abdomen. We're not going to do the transfer. So I went home a broken woman already, that you didn't even give me a chance or anything. So that was a lot. And then I ended up in hospital again because of the hyperstimulation. So then I had to wait another 3 months, and then they froze all the embryos. So they still went through the process of the fertilization, to put in the embryo and the sperm together. And then they said, you've got 19 had fertilized. I said, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I said, this is amazing. They said, so we're going to freeze all of them. I said, well, that's it. That's all my kids there. You know?
Yeah.
So December 2015, we were going to go through the frozen cycle. And they said, how many do you want us to thaw? They said, the thing is that a lot of these embryos may not survive the thawing process. So you can decide to say, we only want to four or five, and you may have zero. And then, you know, obviously, because you stimulated, then that your cycle will then be cancelled. And then you'd have to wait 3 months again. So me and my husband, like, we really prayed about it. And then we said, let's just do all of them. And then whatever God says is whatever God says. So if we end up with six, we know that God's saying that you'll have six kids.
So we
thawed all of them. Only one made it, literally, out of 19. Wow. So we did that transfer, and then it didn't work again. And that was, I think for me, that was the breaking point where I just thought, this is just way too much. I can't do it. You know, I really can't do it. And we had just bought a new house. And it was weird because we bought this big house. It wasn't our intentions to buy. We were just looking for like an investment. And my husband said, oh, look at this property. And just went and looked at it. And then us and the owners, we just got on really well. There were this old white couple who were Christians. And they said, look, we've been praying to God so that the people who will buy this house will make it into a home and take care of it. I thought, okay, well, let's see what we can do. And I remember when people came to the house and they was like, wow, this is a very big house. Why do you guys need a big house? And at first I thought a bit like, this is really silly. Two people do not need to live in a house that is this size. And I remember saying to God, this house is our faith house. We're buying this house in faith that one day it's going to be full up with kids. I don't want people to like come to the house and be like, oh, that's the house that those guys live in and there's only two of them. You know, I don't want that. I don't want to be pointed at. I don't want to be ridiculed. But God, I need this house to be full. And there was a room in the house where they hadn't touched it for years. It was dated. They just used it as storage. Everything else was so nice, but that room. And I decided that this room was going to be my child's room. So we decorated it. It was all neutral colors. And whenever we showed people around the house, they said, oh, what's this room? I said, this is my baby's nursery. And people, oh, are you pregnant? No, I'm not pregnant, but I'm doing this in faith. And then I started waking up at 6 a.m. every morning, sitting in the room praying, God, this room is going to have my child sleeping in it. I don't know when, but it's going to happen. And that's what I did religiously. Every morning, 6 a.m., I'll just go in there. And then I started buying clothes and hanging the clothes up. And it was, at first it felt a bit weird buying clothes for a baby that I don't even know whether it's coming. I don't know when. But I said, no, I'm doing this in faith because I know that I'm going to be a mum. I know what God has shown me. It's not my imagination. I know that this is real. Therefore, I'm going to buy it. I bought the clothes that my child was going to wear home from hospital. I hung up in my wardrobe every morning. I touch it and I pray over it. And I said, I'm using God. I'm telling too many people about who you are.
Yeah,
and not embarrass yourself. Not me. I've told too many people, you know, I've told too many people that I'm waiting on God. I know what God has told me. I said, God, please, there are so many people that doubt you and think that you can't do it. I'm not putting my trust in men, because at the end of the day, all these cycles have failed, which goes to show that it's all in your hands. I can't put everything in the hands of men, of the medical professionals. So do whatever it is that you need to do. So in 2016, we then went on to have the fourth round. And I remember walking into the clinic and the receptionist saying to me, oh, Kemi, how do you, like, they knew us there. They knew us there. You know, we'd been there so long. And they said, how do you feel about this next one? I said, I don't have any expectations. I don't know. And I don't know where it came from, but I finally understood what it meant to let go and let God and just leave it there. And then I stopped praying for myself. I started praying for all the other people that were waiting on God. I had a list of women. I'll just read off their names. God, please do it for this person. Please do it for this person. Because as far as I was concerned, he'd already done it for me. So because he'd done it for me, I just want everyone else to share in the same joy that I was sharing in. So that's what my prayer points became. I had zero expectations. I just said, look, I know what God is doing and I'm okay. I'm okay with it. You know, we still get to travel and everything. But most of all, it's made me realize that I am more than given birth. And I know that when I look at all the women in the Bible who are labeled as barren, they all went on to give birth, all of them, you know, and they gave birth to children of promise. You know, the kids that they gave birth to, they all went on to do such great things. I said, well, I'm waiting for my child of promise. I'm waiting for my miracle child that people are going to say, Kemi's son, he inspires me. Because of Kemi's journey, I too have hope. You know, because of what God has done in Kemi's life. And that was just what I held on to. So in May 2016, every year our church has a retreat, and we went on the retreat and I started bleeding. I thought, are you serious? This thing isn't going to work again. And my husband, I told him, I said, babes, I'm bleeding. He didn't even say anything to me. I think he just walked away and he was gone for about 2 hours. So he'd like completely missed one of the programs. I was thinking, what's this guy doing? And he came back, he said, I just went to talk to God. He said, be at peace. I thought, okay, it's not your body that, you know, you're going to the toilet and you're seeing blood. And then we got home a few days later, we took the test and it was positive.
Wow. And
it was such a surreal feeling. It took so long to sink in. And I thought, and then obviously you have the fear of, oh my gosh, am I going to lose the baby? What's going to happen? And then he just kept saying, I mean, God has told us that this is it. Don't worry. And that was it. That is how God did it. You know, it was such a long journey, but it was definitely worth it. 100% worth it. And then at week 24, when we went for the scan, they said, sorry, your baby's not growing. Your placenta's not working properly. I was just like, really?
Seriously, yeah.
Like, I don't need this. And I said, they said to me, look, we're going to have to deliver the baby early. Ideally, we want to wait until week 28, but we don't think that the baby will make it that far. I said, no, this isn't what God told me. This isn't part of the plan. This is not part of the plan. And then they sent us to the hospitals every 2 weeks. We had to have growth scans. They said, it was weird because they said, your baby's too small, but then there wasn't enough space in my room for him to grow. That even makes sense. How can a baby be too small but there's not enough space? So we just kept going for the growth scans, and then it got to week 33. We went for a routine appointment and they said, no, this baby needs to come out. The heartbeat that we're hearing, it's quite low. And then we said, no, we want to wait. You know, they said, they told us that he's going to be in intensive care until his due date. This is November. You know, it's the 28th of November that they told us he was due the 15th of January. I said, there's no way that he's going to... I said, no. We prayed about it, and then my husband came back and said, babes, God said we've got to do it. I said, oh my gosh. So we did it. And then he was born on my mum's birthday, the 30th of November.
Aww.
And when they delivered my placenta, they said, it's such a good thing that this baby came today because your placenta was black. It wasn't... We don't know what would have happened if he had stayed any longer. I said, God, thank you. So yeah, the devil really tried it, but he's here. He's a miracle. He was only in hospital for 3 weeks. He was grieving on his own. He yeah, he didn't need no oxygen. All he had to do was gain weight. Other than that, he's perfect. And you see him now, you'd never know that, you know, he was premature, born at 33 weeks and everything. He can read, he can write, he can spell his name, you know. So he's doing all the things that a three-year-old, actually, maybe not all three-year-olds know how to read, but yeah.
Wow, that's such an amazing story. He went through so much. And I'm so sorry about your loss, but we do thank God for your rainbow baby and the testimony and how faith kept you going. That was amazing, having a room decorated and purchasing items and putting them in the wardrobe. That's a big one. But it's amazing, right? That the faith kept you going all those times. You never, and the fact that you're also praying for other women, even though you hadn't had your baby.
I still do it now. It's my passion, just because I know how hard it is to wake up every day and renew your hope. Yes. You know, and one of the other things is on December 31st, when, you know, you're praying and you're just like, God, I have one prayer point. I just want to have a baby. And in 2015, I said, God, I'm not going to stand here on December 31st, 2016, praying for another baby. I refuse to have the same prayer point. My prayer point needs to change, because I wasn't praying for anything else. I felt like I had everything but a baby. So I still pray, encourage other women if they want to ask me any questions. And that's why I don't mind telling my story, being an open book, because I know what it's like. I know what depression feels like when you have suicidal thoughts. I know what that feels like. And it's just, I wouldn't wish it on anyone. Sorry, I'm getting so emotional. I wouldn't wish it on anyone. And I know, in terms of the stigma of, you know, oh, you're still waiting, no baby. People around you are having multiple babies. And then people are asking such insensitive questions. And you just feel, I don't want to write unexplained infertility on my forehead. I don't want to write, I've had a miscarriage. It's none of your business. You don't know what it's taken for me to wake up and shower today. You know, there are days where, like, I'll just stay in bed. I'd call in sick, because I don't want to face the realities of waking up and seeing someone outside with a baby. I don't want to face that. So I know what people are going through. So I just want people to know that there's hope. And as long as you can hang on to that hope, and as long as you believe what you see, then I don't know how long it would take. Like, my journey was 5 years. Some people, it may be, like, my journey is no different from someone who's waiting 1 year. You know, my journey is no different from someone who's waiting 8 years. But I know that if you have that hope and that faith, there's nothing that God can't do. Nothing.
Amen to that. Thank you. And I know that you talked a lot about your faith and how it held you on, but how did you also find support during your waiting time? Did you have friends, other friends dealing with something similar, or?
Yeah, it's a very weird situation, because there was four of us who were going through the same thing, all at the same church. Absolutely crazy. And I was with my god sister Lola. We were dieting together. We would, every evening we'd go and jog. You know, we would, so the 6 a.m. prayers that I'd have, she too would wake up, go into a room and pray. We'd text each other prayer time. And then once we finished praying, maybe 6:30, 6:45, we'd call each other and we'd pray together. She didn't go through IVF, but she went through Clomid first.
Oh, okay.
And her first two cycles failed. And then she had an encounter where she was with this little boy, and this boy said, Auntie Lola, there's an angel behind you. And she said, okay. Really? He said, yeah, he's putting a baby in your tummy. And she was pregnant. Literally, that is her encounter. That is her supernatural, you know. And we'd always said that we're going to do this together. So when she got pregnant, her baby was due. Her baby was born in June 2016. And we always said, oh, we want our boys to grow up together. Yeah. We want them to be born in the same year. And I said, oh, Lola, sorry, my baby is coming in 2017. But he came in 2016, and Josiah and Samuel, they are so close. They are brothers, you know. Wow. We call them twins, everything, you know. So we were on the journey together, both our outcomes were different. And then she then went on to have another baby within less than 2 years later. Wow. So if, yeah, everyone's journey is different. But in terms of the support, when I became vocal about what I was going through, you know, I found that people would always ask, Kemi, how are you doing? How are you? And everything. So for me, I didn't want anyone to feel sorry for me. Yeah. I just wanted you to pray with me and ask how you could support me. So people more or less did that. It was only the people who I don't have no filter that would ask silly questions and, yeah, you know, say, have you tried this? Or don't put too much salt in your husband's food. Things like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I never heard that one. That's interesting. Salt and food. Okay.
Yeah. I just thought, I don't even cook with salt anyway, you know. But it was good. The network that I then made via Instagram was just amazing. The Trying to Conceive community. My husband he hates social media. And yeah, I guess social media can be vanity for some people and fake lives. But yeah, for me, the people that I follow, I'm very intentional. And the Trying to Conceive community, I just think it's amazing. I've met some pretty amazing people. I met you.
I've watched you for years, isn't
it? Yeah. So it's been good. I think when my husband and I, when we got married, we, in terms of our network of friends, we all live within 10 minutes away from each other. Nice. So we're quite close. And people, they're just so supportive. I've got another friend who has, you know, just like she, within the first year of her getting married, she was pregnant. And she, what I loved is that she just said, Kemi, we're going to share in this joy together. And I was so close with her daughter. I remember when I took the test of the third round of IVF that failed, I was actually babysitting her daughter. I just cried, you know. And I remember her daughter, she wasn't even one yet. She just wiped my tears away. So, like, aww, it was just, we have such a special bond with the people that we're connected to. And I really thank God for it.
Wow, that's amazing. And is that how 9 months in the waiting, the blog, is that how that came to be, or?
When did that start? That started in 2016, January 2016. Oh, okay. So that was after the third round of IVF. That was when I finally said, God, I'm letting this go and I'm leaving it. I'm not praying about it anymore. And then I said, actually, let me just talk about it. Let me share my experience with other people, because I know that I can't be the only person who's going through it. Because even though I was secretly following people on Instagram, it wasn't Black people that I was following. I didn't find any Black people. It was all white people, or it was people in America who talk about it. But I thought, is there no one in the UK, no Black people in the UK that is struggling with infertility? Is there no Nigerian people? Like, I didn't find anyone. And then I started the blog. I started posting more about, you know, my blog on Instagram, and that's when I started meeting people and connecting. So the blog was, I've always kept journals from when I was a teenager. So I just thought, well, you know, there's nothing here that's a big secret or anything. I don't, you know, what are people going to do with the information? I'm the one who's put it there. So if they decide they want to gossip about me, I don't care.
Yeah.
You know, so it just got to the point where I was just like, I don't care. People go through things. And people are suffering. People, depression is real, and that can lead to so many different things. And if you don't get help and speak out about what you're going through, then, or if you can't see people that you can identify with, then you can end up in like such a bad place. People end up dead, you know. So I just said, well, I'm gonna talk about it. I'm gonna write a blog, and even if it helps one person, then I know that my job is done, you know. And that was just why I continued to do it. I haven't written for quite a while, but people still contact me via the blog or via Instagram and ask me questions. And sometimes they don't even follow me on Instagram, but I know that if I put a post up, they may, you know, send me a message and say, I saw your post, blah, blah. And it's okay, because I know that, you know, people watch who you follow, people watch who you like, you know. There's so much pressure from society. It's crazy.
Well, thank you for that blog, because I saw that couple of years ago, and I used to read it, and it really helped me as well. And I'm sure many other people were touched by it. And like you noted earlier, there's not a lot of Black people talking about this, and even Nigerians for sure. Do you think that has changed since you started talking about it? Because I know for sure your face is one of the faces, a few faces I see talking about this on social media at all.
Yeah, I think more people are talking about it, but I don't think it's as much as, especially from like the Black community, I don't think there's as many people who are talking. I think there's still the notion of I'm going to set up an Instagram page for fertility awareness, but it's just there's no faces there or anything like that. So I guess that stigma still is there.
It is, yes.
And it's, I guess it's evident in the fact how many people message me. There was a lady that I connected with in the UK last year. Okay. And so she's doing a lot more. When I think about like the UK, there's not that many of us that's doing it. You may see a few within the Asian community, but I still feel like there's such a long way to go where people feel that this is a disease. You know, yeah. I went to an event at the Houses of Parliament where I got the opportunity to speak about fertility treatment and how it shouldn't be something that, you know, it depends on where you live in the UK, whether you're eligible for it. It's a disease, you know. And one of the politicians said, infertility is a disease. It's not a lifestyle choice. I said, that's so true. Yeah. You know, it's, and no one chooses to have cancer. No one chooses to have, you know, all these other diseases. No, if you don't go to the shop and say, okay, well, you know, what disease can I pick? You know, let's have
exactly.
that.
Exactly,
you know,
yeah.
You know, it happens. And over here, like the NHS, they spend so much money on awareness for stop smoking campaigns. That's a choice, you know? Exactly. But yet, infertility, there's not that much money that's pumped into it. There's not much money that's pumped into PCOS awareness, that they're not telling young girls that it's not normal to not have a period. It's not normal to have irregular periods, that if you have irregular periods, if your periods are really heavy, if you're constantly having bloatedness, if you're having stomach aches, you need to go and get it checked out. It's not normal. There's not enough money that's pumped into educating society as to the things that they need to look out for infertility, but they pump money for type 2 diabetes. That is to do with your lifestyle and smoking. Sorry, I'm getting angry.
But it's true, right? Because people always think, especially when you say IVF, they're like, oh, okay, you're kind of trying to choose a designer baby. And it's like, no, you know, people need to do that. They don't want to, right? It's not.
Yeah, that is that. I've heard of that. So yeah. People sometimes they say to me, oh, when they find out that Samuel is an IVF baby, they say, oh, okay, did you choose the sex? No.
You know, like, seriously?
Why would I do that? I just wanted a child. I don't care. I genuinely didn't care whether it was a boy or whether it was a girl. As long as the child was healthy and it's living, who cares? It's not that deep. You know, I just prayed for a child, and as long as the child is healthy, I'm okay.
Yeah, some people need to know that more. So you're still working a lot more then with in the UK to try to increase more awareness, especially for young girls and the youth to know more about PCOS, and like you said, people to be able to get help faster. And it seems even the doctors not all of them seem to know what's going on, because, you know, like your doctor kept on telling you to go back and forth and not see the need to help.
There is so one of the things that I have noticed with a lot of people that I'm friends with on Instagram in the UK is that we all have the same common thing, that GPs don't take it seriously. Especially if you're a certain age. So because I was under 30, oh, you're young, you know, don't you want to have a career, blah blah blah. No, I don't. It's none of your business. Yeah. it's none of your business. But there needs to be more awareness. So I work with my local clinical commissioning group, CCG. Right. Okay. So CCGs, they're the ones who decide how much money gets pumped into what area of health funding in each UK borough. So I work with them, and I've, you know, they call me sometimes when they want to make decisions. I've spoken to they have events once a month where every GP in the borough attends, and I've spoken at those events. They've called me in for consultations to say, okay, this is what we want to do, what do you think? So I'll work quite closely with them in terms of just trying to make sure that everyone gets fair treatment, and just educating the GPs that this is something that is potentially, you know, traumatizing for, yeah, for whether it's male infertility factor or female infertility factor. People go through a lot. There needs to be some element of empathy and sensitivity when you're dealing with them. You can't just be, okay, what's wrong? Okay, you know, okay, do this, do that. You can't fob people off and make them feel like their concerns and the sadness, the emotions that they're feeling isn't real. So that's something that I hope that will change. I also volunteer with Fertility Network UK, which is the UK's leading fertility charity on, you know, creating awareness and supporting people who are going through the journey. So I've done quite a few campaigns with them, and if they need volunteers for things, then they may call me up for that. The other thing is that my story is actually now permanently in the Science Museum in London.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they called me, I can't remember if it was last year. It was meant to be, they were celebrating 40 years of the first IVF baby.
Oh, yes.
So I was invited to that event, and they asked me if my story could be featured. And I said yes. And then late last year, they got in contact and said, and we're going to make it a permanent IVF, a permanent feature in the Science Museum under human biology, and we'd like your story to be there.
It's amazing. Yay.
That's what it's about.
Exactly.
That's it. As long as you don't take out anything what I've mentioned, God, mm-hmm, you can do it. I don't
exactly
mind.
That's true. What,
yeah. I always say that to people. Yeah. If you want me to talk, I'm going to talk about my faith. If you have an issue about it, then I'm not interested. Simple.
Thank you for pushing that as well, because it is important, because again, like people say, people assume that IVF for treatment is automatic, you know, and like you noted, it's no guarantees, and there is a huge God factor in all of that, you know. Without God saying it's going to work, it still doesn't have to work. Even with, you know, 30-40 eggs, there's no guarantee, but he's still God making it happen. So thank you for promoting that, let people know.
It's all
and where's people, that little kid that is the angel? Where's his number? I need his number to go find an angel. Because I thought that was so amazing. Like, whoa, seriously?
I think he's actually based in Nigeria, because my god sister and her mum, they run like tuition and summer school. So this was at a summer school. So I think he actually came over from Nigeria. I think he's,
I need his number. He's like, okay, hey.
or he's at boarding school.
That was amazing. That's an amazing story. So knowing what you know now, what is the one piece of advice you would give someone, your younger self or someone else dealing with PCOS about how to deal with it?
I definitely say pay attention to your body. Right. If I was speaking to my 16-year-old self, my 19-year-old self, I'd definitely say that I don't think I would have gone on the pill. I would have pushed a lot more for investigations. And had I known that PCOS can be managed by your diet, I would have changed my diet a long time ago. My weight fluctuations were just out of this world. There were days where if I didn't want to eat lunch, I'd just go and buy chocolate and a packet of crisps and I was fine. Right. And obviously when you have PCOS, you have higher levels of insulin, you're more at risk of having type 2 diabetes because your body can't process like all the glucose and everything. So if I'd known that, I would have been more conscious of the amount of chocolate that I was eating and just really managing my diet. One of the things that I am grateful for is that if you ask me what day did you have your period, what day was your cycle 10 years ago, I could tell you.
Really?
My mum I have it all written down. My mum, as soon as you start your period, she bought you a diary, you track the period.
Wow.
You know, so that's how I knew that this thing was regular. It wasn't because some days it was 5 days or 4 days. It was my cycle was 21 days, 41 days, 100 days, 80 days. So, you know, it was all over the place. So I have that down. So it's really important that young people, no matter how old you are, track your periods, like see what the pattern is. If it's irregular, ideally you should have a 21 day, 20, 28 day, 30 day cycle yeah. or so. So if it's out, you know, just know that you may need to go and get it checked to see what's going on. And just so that you can pick up on any abnormalities. So, yeah. you know, that if it's a 21 day cycle at this point, are your breasts bigger? What's happening? You know, so just so that you can pick up. So like, God forbid, if anything does happen, you know, okay, this isn't normal or anything. And also don't be afraid to ask questions and to reach out for help. For a long time, because I felt that like my body was failing, I didn't say anything. I didn't talk about how I feel. And your feelings at the end of the day. No one can tell you that what you're feeling is wrong. So definitely speak up, speak out, and ask for help where it's needed, because going at it alone is not a great thing. But yeah, and most of all, just for people who do have faith, some people, you know, they have, I don't know, Buddha, yoga, whatever, but whatever it is that you're putting your faith in, be diligent with it. I know that, you know, I believe it, I've seen it, and I believe it will come to pass.
Wow. Well said. Thank you. And as a wrap up, any words of encouragement for other couples dealing with infertility?
Whilst you're on the way, enjoy each other. I know it's easier said than done, and it's probably a cliche thing, but enjoy the time and find out more about each other. And like I said previously, that every day when you wake up, you're renewing your hope. Just every day renew it. Just renew it, and you know, just say that it's a great day. I'm going to have a great day. A lot of the times I'll wake up and say, this is the day that the Lord has made. I'll rejoice and be glad in it. Regardless what has happened, I choose to be happy. Because if I always say that if you can win upstairs, then the rest is secondary, because the battle is in the mind. So for anyone who's on the journey, as long as that battlefield in the mind, you know that every day you're winning that battle, because it is a daily battle that you're going through. Just know that everything else is secondary, and it can happen. But most of all, if you believe in God, just trust. Look at Sarah, you know, on paper, shouldn't have happened.
No. You know, it's over 90, right? Well, she was 90.
Over 90, 90. Yeah. Yeah, it's, and remember when you know, they visited, the angel visited her and said, you're gonna have a baby. She laughed.
Yeah,
you know, God doesn't move according to our own time, but on paper they may say, okay, well, low sperm count, PCOS, something. They can have a list of everything on paper, but God can 100% make it happen. And she gave birth to her Isaac. Look at Hannah. She went, she kept, carried on praying, went back, kept going back year after year. And God did it. You know, so just have hope. And I'm not saying it very lightly. I'm saying it because I've been there. And I know that God is God. Even after my journey with cancer, you know, that's where they say chemotherapy, it ruins your chances of having a baby. Do not get pregnant. You cannot afford to get pregnant. Kemi, it's very dangerous for you. Please. I know the God that I serve, and I know that if it's meant to be, he will make a way. I don't need to trust in whatever your science says, because at the end of the day, you can't tell me why black women are most likely to die.
Yeah.
It's okay. But just keep the hope and know that the final report is always God's. Even if it's 10 years later, God is God, and he will show people that he is who he says he is, and his word doesn't lie. It doesn't.
No, never. Thank you. Well said. And just to actually ask, I know that you said now you're doing a lot of work as well for breast cancer awareness. How can people reach you? Do you have a page for that, or is there?
I haven't launched the page. It's strange because the initiative that I'm launching, that I've launched, is called Tea Cups. And that's because I love tea.
Yes, me too. Yeah.
I really love tea, and then cups as in like your cups, your breasts.
Right. Okay.
So yeah. So I'm trying to, the name teacups has taken, like there's two teacups, 10 teacups, it's all been taken on Instagram. So I'm still trying to figure out what the name is going to be. So for the meantime, still follow me via my Instagram page, Kemi_Kems. Via my blog, I always respond to messages if I'm really bad at my phone, as you've probably experienced. But yeah, you can just reach me there. I'm doing an Instagram live tomorrow.
Okay.
At 8:30, just showing people how to check for breasts.
Okay, that's great.
I'm doing that every month. Yeah,
that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Kemi. It's been pretty amazing hearing your story. It's such a testimony. It's huge. It showed me things I also need to do, so that praying at a certain time, peek and pray and have faith and purchase some items for my triplets. So, you know. Yeah. You know, so I have to, so thank you so much for sharing that and reminding us that God is God and that there's nothing impossible with him.
Amen.
And like Kemi said, if you do want to reach her, she's on Instagram at Kemi_Kems. Details will also be in the show notes. So thank you so much, Kemi. It's been a pleasure having you on here today. Have a good afternoon.
You too. Thank you.
Thanks for joining us this week on the Fertility Conversations podcast. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a 5-star rating and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram at Fertility Conversations. If there are any topics you would like to have discussed, please send an email to fertilityconversations@gmail.com. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. Thank you again for listening. Take care of yourself and do stay hopeful.